Let's hear it on a Monday. It's 7 minutes past 10 o'clock. Today, I'm actually pretty lucky to be talking to Dr. Scott Borma. Thanks to some changes in my schedule, I'm able to share with our listeners a preview of a wonderful concert coming up Sunday that is free to all. It's held in Miller Auditorium, and it starts at 3 o'clock. Yes, the bands are back. The University Wind Symphony is the centerpiece, and the symphonic band, well, equal halves, I would guess, I'm thinking. So, Scott, please take over. I'm rambling at this point.
Good morning. It's so, so nice great to see you. It's so great to be back. And, yeah, as you say, bands are back. It's just thrilling to start getting back to a little bit more normalcy. Not exactly normal. We still have our COVID protocols in place, and but we're just so thrilled to be playing major works again with the full ensemble. All year last year, we did all chamber music, which was delightful, but we were all spread 10 feet apart. And it's a little hard, you know, the word ensemble means coming together, and so we felt very distanced from each other all year last year. And so it's just, I'll never forget our first rehearsal this fall, having everybody in the room, and just the energy and emotions were palpable, and just thrilled to be able to make music together again.
I've been thrilled, too, to be able to attend a lot of in-person events this fall. Memorable ones, you know, that just, I'm sure you have too. I'm excited to see, just excited to be in the audience as well.
There's just a renewed sense of joy at doing this together. And it really made us appreciate what we didn't have for a while. And we're having a blast.
Well, a lot of people made it possible by getting vaccinated and following protocols. Yep. And otherwise we'd still be in virtual world right now.
Absolutely. So. And as we've talked on your show before, we had all kinds of protocols for the wind instruments, especially covering their bell covers with these nylon covers, masks with slits in them, and there were countless oboe and bassoon reeds cracking, trying to get them through these slits. And we went as far last year as to having these nylon bags over the woodwind instruments, because their sound doesn't just come out of the bell, it comes out of all the holes. So we had to cover it all up, and they had to find their hand holes to find their keys, and yes, it was quite a trial.
Yeah. You were following the science at the time, right? You know, and at the time there were very few trials and things that could indicate which way to go. But there were some schools, I think University of Colorado was really in front of this, trying to put out studies that showed. And I remember our discussions were always based on the most recent information.
Yeah, we're so fortunate that enough people got together and commissioned these studies to give us some guidance, because I remember last summer, just what are we going to do? And and that really helped us pave the way to making it safe for our students and each other.
So you had time to contemplate a coming back concert, which is, again, Sunday at 3 o'clock in Miller Auditorium. It's also good to be back in Miller Auditorium, which was dark and vacant for a full year or more. And
we're actually one behind you. We actually did have a concert in October. Mm-hmm. So we did have a trial run on it. Each band had their own concert. Just to see, I have a live audience and hear their response. Last year was all live streamed or just doing our own events with no audiences. And just the feedback, the communication, the collaboration with the audience was such a thrill to feel. But I think it was overwhelming for all of us to get back on that stage in Miller, this huge auditorium with the lights coming down on. There were actually people there. I think we all were a little bit discombobulated with the experience. So we're looking forward to Sunday's concert being a little, okay, we remember how this goes, and let's make it happen.
Okay. Two bands. How many people are now currently in each band?
Yeah, the symphonic band is probably about 65 members. The wind symphony is probably about 60 members.
That's a lot.
Yeah. So the symphonic band will start the concert at 3 o'clock, and they'll play for about 50 minutes, and then the wind symphony will probably play a little bit before 4 o'clock for their portion of the concert.
The program is really appealing in that there are some absolute classics that you're bringing back, as well as pieces by composers I don't know. Kevin Day, born in 1996.
Right.
Pretty young, starting off the University Symphonic Band portion of the concert. Then the Petite Symphonie by Charles Gounod, which I have a very fond memories of playing myself on flute. Mason Bates, a big name in composition.
With electronics are incorporated into the sounds. It's a very unique sound.
Rusty Air in Carolina. I'm curious about what that could be.
Yeah.
Possibly be about. And then Vaughan Williams and Alfred Reed. So that's the first half of the concert. And then the University Wind Symphony takes the stage. And it begins with a work called El Muro. And we are very fortunate to have the composer of the piece right here in the studio at Classical WMUK. I would like to welcome Dr. Ricardo Lorenz, who is a professor of composition at Michigan State University, originally from Venezuela and a longtime resident of the United States. Thank you very much for joining us here today.
Oh, thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here in this wonderful institution that I had not had the fortune of visiting until now. So
you
I
must
feel
be very
honored.
Busy at Michigan State.
Yes, yes, yes. So, but it's great to finally come here and work with Scott Borma. And I'm just excited to hear what the students are doing.
Dr. Borma has a lot of great things to say about this piece, but before we have a chance to hear it as well, before we get to the present day and El Muro, which means the wall, I'd like to hear about what attracted you to composing in the beginning and what piano pieces. Did you play an instrument and write for your own instrument? What kind of thing got you started?
Yes, what got me started, two things. So my grandmother... used to teach piano. But, you know, all grandchildren kind of feel that grandmothers are a little bit like imposing themselves. So I said, no, I'm not going to study piano with my grandma. I'm going to do it myself. And in fact, she wanted to teach me how to read music, but I said, no, I'm going to invent my own system. But thank God, right away, I realized that's a little more difficult than I thought. And also, why invent a new system if there's one in place that works really well? But sort of, so that whole relationship with notation and thinking that I can invent my own system actually was, you know, taking me through a path of creativity as opposed to performance early on. And yes, and I, of course, then I did study piano and I you know, went to conservatory. The other thing that made me realize the power of music was that my mother early on had suffered mental illness early on, but I saw how her at 40 years old practicing piano, the good it did to her and her well-being. So I thought, wow, if that does that to my mom, imagine what it can do to me. So those two things were very important. So two women, very powerful women in my life, had a lot to do with me deciding to get into composition.
The therapeutic power of music and the creative inroads one can make, even as a 6 or 7 year old. It allows you to build your own worlds. And what kind of worlds do you build? Meaning, I guess today's composers have many things to draw on. I'm thinking of what direction of tonality do you like? What other composers may have been your favorites that give you part of the language you might use today?
Great question. All the above, meaning I've absorbed all the influences that that you can think of growing up in the 70s, where the record industry sort of bloomed and there was all kinds of stuff available. So from the classical point of view, my first favorite composer was Maurice Ravel. And I remember early on buying an album of all the piano works of Ravel played by Philippe Tremond. And I remember writing in a very naive way, you know, I'm going to dedicate all my music to you, Maurice Ravel, you know, because I had read a biography on him, and I finally just fascinated what this whole thing of, you know, having a life as a composer was. In the meantime, I also played in rock bands and fusion bands, and then, you know, jazz came into the scene, and then later on, you know, tango. And so I can say that my music draws in all those influences and what I remember about those and how those musics felt to me, both classical and popular and rock. So, and I learned a lot from having early on as an adolescent a rock band, because I realized that I could actually engineer these compositions in real time and on the spot, and I got feedback right away. So we didn't have computers back then. Now we get feedback right away from a computer. We didn't back then. So yeah, it's very vast. I would say that I've focused more recently on the relationship between the U.S. and Latin America, and because it's been symbiotic, culturally speaking. So I try to always focus on that, and because there's a lot there to dig out as far as the influence back and forth musically speaking.
Absolutely, Venezuelan composers of short miniatures like Lauro and others brought a version of Chopin melody to the Americas, and well beyond that. There is so much. Folk elements also, do they appear in your compositions?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Now, it's interesting, though. Growing up in Venezuela, when I was growing up, there was not a lot of emphasis on the very rich folk music like there is right now, because the radios were pretty much broadcasting the same music that were being broadcast here in the U.S. I mean, rock, the Beatles, Led Zeppelin, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. So that was the influence we were receiving. And when it was not from the U.S., it was from the Caribbean, mainly Afro-Cuban music. Mm-hmm. So even though Venezuela has a very rich folk tradition, I was more influenced by American music and by Afro-Cuban music, meaning salsa and all that. It was later on through, I think, looking back, something very smart that one of the presidents did. He established what he called that one-to-one, meaning that every piece of foreign music that was played in the radio had to be matched by a national piece of music. Mm-hmm. And that's when folk music suddenly came into the scene, and we started to hear how wonderful it was.
I grew up in Canada, and we had much the same kind of attitude that,
yeah,
you know, for all the American music, we need to match it with a Canadian original pieces on the radio, at least.
My awareness of folk music finally was realized through that program, through that system.
Okay, the part about being in a rock band, you probably have very firm opinions on feel and groove and rhythm, and sometimes it's hard to translate on the page to a symphonic band, for example, or any kind of large ensemble. Like, can they? I mean, if you're including that in your music, there are times when bands don't seem to groove don't have drums and bass.
Can I react to that for a moment?
Okay,
here, upon beginning my study of his score of El Muro, he goes variations of this melody through all these different kinds of grooves, most of which I'd never heard the name of what it was, and still inspired me to research what are all these grooves and listen to examples of what these kind of feels are, and they're distinctly but subtly different in so many ways, and to try to impart that to the students. If I've said groove one time, I've said it 1,000 times, just getting people to, you know, they're working so hard. All the parts are very difficult, and they're working so hard to get their parts right, but it's about feeling it with everybody, and that's been our biggest challenge.
Does that take some time?
Oh, yeah.
But so Scott sent me a recording of the rehearsal of last week, and I just told him that he was saying the right things to the ensemble. And one of the things that I noticed right away when Scott would sing back like the main motive, he would do it like he was scatting. He go, sa do do babi di da da, and said, yes, that's exactly the feeling. It's not just a go. It's not da 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 da. It's not that.
Yeah.
So And I think what it takes is, and this is something I want to share with the students today, is what it takes for that to happen is to think lyrically. Do not think, oh, these are complicated rhythms, these are syncopated rhythms, but these are melodies. These are and because they're folk melody or inspired by folk and popular music, they need to have a certain articulation, and that articulation is closer to jazz than it is to classical music. And when you start making those connections and relationships, the performers get it right away because they have heard enough music to realize. So they change the embouchure, for example. They start subdividing inside, you know, in 16 notes while they're singing lyrically, and suddenly everything falls into place. Mm. And then there's something closer to what we call grooving or swinging in popular music. Now, however, I would be ignorant to think that, yes, we're going to get the grooving that we get in a four-piece band. We never do. So you have to, as you're composing, you're also translating what groove means for a trio of drums, you know, electric, bass and piano, and what it means for a band of 80 performers. Because there is a translation that has to happen from the point of inception when you're composing it. You can't just translate it directly.
If you just tuned in, my guests are Ricardo Lorenz, who is a professor of composition at Michigan State University, and Dr. Scott Borma, who is director of bands at Western Michigan University. And we are previewing a concert Sunday at 3 o'clock featuring the University Symphonic Band on the first half and the University Wind Symphony on the second half. And the piece we are talking about currently, El Muro, is starting off the Wind Symphony portion. It's the beginning of the second half. Before we hear the piece, let's hear about the inspiration of the title, El Muro.
Yes, El Muro is Spanish for the wall, and I always say, not to be confused with Pink Floyd's The Wall, an album that I know very well. But this is about, in a specific wall or fence, but in general, about all walls, what they mean, why are walls built? And I was telling Scott earlier that even though this piece is inspired by a wall that stands between the U.S. and Mexico, it's really a reflection of how I grew up in a city, the city of Caracas, where each home is almost like a makeshift fortress. There's a wonderful homes, but they're all surrounded by these big, tall walls with barbed wire. And since early on, I was sensitive to the fact that, you know, people become prisoners in their own little worlds by building these walls. And at the end, it's simply they're there to sort of to keep people away. That's the bottom line. So this piece reflects a little bit on that from the conceptual point of view. Mm. And kind of tries to humanize, you know, who is left out, who is on the other side of the wall and why.
Let's hear this piece. It's called The Wall, El Muro, written by Dr. Ricardo Lorenz. And we'll be back with more on this concert, which is Sunday at 3 o'clock in Miller Auditorium, free to all. That is music by my guest, Dr. Ricardo Lorenz, and it's a piece called El Muro, The Wall. It's a really, really dazzling piece of music. My other guest here, Dr. Scott Borma, will be conducting the piece Sunday at 3 o'clock in Miller Auditorium when the university bands take the stage, the symphonic band first, and in the second half, starting with this piece, the Wind Symphony. If I was in your band, Scott, I would, every single time I picked up the flute, I would think my part's the most important part. Everybody has melody and rhythm, and something seems like very important to do.
Playing this piece, no matter what instrument you play, you feel like you have the most important part, because every part has such great, not only rhythmic complexity, but great lyricism and great dynamic contrast. There's just so much that Ricardo is asking of the students, and I think they're loving it.
And it's your job to say, actually, I'm going to put this section a little ahead or a little above the others. You know, here's what I want to bring out.
But he's done the score is fascinating to me, and we haven't talked about it, but his use of dynamics in the various parts is fascinating. That somebody would be playing fortissimo and somebody else would be playing piano, somebody else would be playing mezzo forte to get just the right balances that he wants. It makes my job easier because they have all the written instructions right there for them, but it's pretty fun to navigate all that.
And still the composer's not satisfied with how he did it.
Exactly. That's what I'm worried about an hour from now.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm not satisfied with how I, you know, put the dynamics.
Right, I
could have done a better job.
Yeah.
Yes, we do have to get both of you to rehearsal at 11 o'clock, and we are on track to do that. The one thing I wanted to say about walls, you put up a wall, I'm very certain to be curious about what's behind it. As soon as there's a block, you want to go around it, or you want to know what's happening behind it, and you think it's much, much more interesting than it probably is. But there was a section of almost nostalgia, you know, a distant hearing. I mean, what's going on over there? Mm-hmm. That pulled me in as well, this idea.
Oh, that's wonderful. And I don't want to give away the ending, because that's a big feature of the piece. But in essence, that's what the piece is about. You know, you build this wall, but there's people on the other side. There's things happening on the other side. So the question is, does the piece eventually show what's on the other side?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's a big question mark. You have to come to the concert, too.
That's right.
To see.
Well, we will never not want to know what's on the other side
of
a wall. It's only human. Back to Ravel, the composer that pulled you in to begin with. I think of course, Color and Control. Ravel was not, you know, this big sloppy romantic like Rachmaninoff, you know, with heart on sleeve all the time and just, put it together, Rachmaninoff, you know, bring it in. Ravel was controlled, but it was so beautiful. And I think you've gone in a similar path as well.
I wish. Thank you for it. I wish. I mean, his music is crisp. It's so well articulate. Talk about rhythm. Mm. I wish I could articulate the rhythm like he does, based on his background, and that's what I strive for. I don't think I achieve it, but that's what drew me into his music. That and the lyricism of his music, and also how he was inspired by also other cultures. You know, he has a piece inspired on habanera. He has a piece inspired on jazz and blues. A lot of that was part of why I became so attracted to his music.
Now, what other kinds of works are in your catalog? What else have you focused on? This is a band piece.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you what I'm doing right now. I mean, I just had a premiere of a piano trio, you know, the typical classic template, which not a lot of people write for because there's not a lot of trios there. But I just had a premiere just Friday by a wonderful trio called Reverón Trio. Happened to be all Venezuelans who are scattered around the U.S. teaching at different universities. So I just did that. And right now I'm writing a piece for the Los Angeles Philharmonic, which I'm very excited about. So
it's kind of a big deal.
But I'm having so much fun. I'm very nervous, but it's just it's just happening, and I'm very happy about that. And
was it a wide open commission, or did they say we pictured this?
Yeah, well, they want something short to open a program in this coming May, and the program has two extraordinary works. Petrushka, Stravinsky Petrushka, and then a wonderful piece by one of my favorite Latin American composers, Silvestre Revueltas, The Night of the Mayas, La Noche de los Mayas, which is an epic piece with, you know, I don't know, 50 percussionists. And so this my little piece has to open up that program. So it's a big bar. But I think I have the right idea, and it's working really well.
The pieces are inspiring, as you know, as they are with the. Both pieces have huge sounds, and as you said, massive percussion.
Yeah, and something I noticed, these are the things you think about, that the pieces are very sectionalized, and very, especially Petrushka, believe it or not, is very chamber music-like, and very, you know, broken into little pieces. So I thought I need to do something that's about, you know, 6-8 minutes. It's just one single thing, you know, just, you know, to contrast those. So that's kind of cues that you get. They don't tell you those things, but when you hear what they're going to do, you make a decision in how your piece is going to be, is going to unfold.
Will you be at Sunday's concert, or are you here just to put your ears on the rehearsals?
No, I wouldn't miss that. I this is a very meaningful piece for me. I have never had the fortune to working with Scott Borman, the Western Michigan Wind Symphony. So yeah, I'm going to be here.
That's great. It's at 3 o'clock Sunday in Miller Auditorium, and you can find details at the School of Music website, wmich.edu/music/events. We should probably touch on the other pieces on the program, Scott, that the Wind Symphony has prepared.
Yeah, coming up with a repertoire for the season was both a joy and a terror, since we have not done full ensemble pieces in a year and a half. My goal was I'd like to make sure that each concert has a classic standard band repertoire piece. The first concert in October, we opened with the Hindemith Symphony in B flat. This concert, we will close with Percy Grainger's Lincolnshire Posy. And the rest of the season has those kind of landmark band pieces as their heart. But then I wanted to surround them with variety and different kinds of voices. And I wanted to make sure that we're hearing all kinds of sounds available to the ensemble throughout the course of the year. And which is, of course, a big reason for choosing Ricardo's piece. We're going to follow his piece with a completely different kind of sound. It happens to be a piece by Alfred Reed called, it's the second movement of his third symphony, and it's called Variations on the Perazzi Theme of Wagner. And Richard Wagner, late in his life, they say he was heard playing this theme, and he had intentions of having this theme being in a piece of his, but it never came to full fruition. There's a story that he was heard playing it on his piano the night he died, and it was dedicated to his wife. So it's just this beautiful little motive that Alfred Reed takes and creates this romantic, lush Wagnerian movement out of. It's just absolutely gorgeous. We follow that with Adolphus Hellstork's work, American Guernica. And again, the Alfred Reed, the Perazzi theme, just beautiful, heart-wrenching, romantic. And then we go into very tragic music by Hellstork. And it composed it to commemorate the 1963 bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama. And it's dedicated to the four girls that were killed in this bombing. So it's definitely a very heart-wrenching, terrifying piece. And yet it has scenes of that church music. You'll hear quotes of Jesus loves me, yes, I know, this I know. And American Guernica is based on the famous Pablo Picasso painting, Guernica, and the fascist bombing in this Basque village, and just the terror and all this symbolism in the painting. Hellstork has taken and kind of used it to tell his story of this bombing, and so pretty powerful music. And then we close with Percy Grainger's Lincolnshire Posy, just a great six-movement work based on English folk tunes that he collected and recorded, wrote it in 1937. But the stories behind all of these tunes that he collected and the singers, these just common person singing on the street that he's recording them sing this song, you know, the meanings that these folk tunes have to the people, and trying to express that in his own language throughout its piece. And so we're subtitling our portion of the concert Hidden Meanings. So, of course, Ricardo has talked about the wall and the multiple meanings that conjures. Of course, the meanings behind the Perazzi theme and the mysterious aspect of why that was composed, why it was never, in a major work. Of course, the meanings behind the Baptist bombings in Birmingham and Percy Grainger's collection. So a lot of variety to soak up in one fell swoop.
I kind of like that you finish with the Grainger to get people walking outside.
Yeah, yeah.
For the end of, it's very much
leave you with something to whistle.
Yeah, and to picture yourself again in a meadow or outside,
right.
Can I ask Scott a question?
Oh, I
quickly,
think I guess.
How difficult it is to put together such a solid, well-connected program?
It takes a lot of time and effort. I really take it very seriously. I think most of us do, and we feel like there's an educational component. I want to make sure that all of our students in the 4 or 5 years that they're here are exposed to the masterworks, and I want them to be exposed to new sounds and new ideas and everything in between. And how do you mix it in a concert? You've got an hour or so to put together a package that not just has variety, but somehow interconnects and takes you on a journey through it. There's a famous, I have this video clip that I always see of Jerry Junkin, the director of bands at the University of Texas at Austin, that says, the challenge is you're going to choose an hour of music out of all the possibilities over hundreds of years of music being written. And basically you are saying, I'm rejecting everything else for this. That's a pretty big responsibility. Maybe we take it too seriously, but
so it's a process of elimination, pretty much.
Right. And sometimes I desperately want to do this piece, but it just doesn't fit anywhere in the schedule. And so, well, we'll put it on the back burner for next year. And because it's not just about playing great music, it's about having an experience for the audience, takes them on a ride that we hopefully that makes them want to come back to the next one.
And you must take into account the conducting preparation. I mean, there's some real challenges
in this program.
But
that makes it fun.
Oh, that's great. Well, why don't we finish with Lincolnshire Posy, some tunes from that wonderful classic work, 1937, you said. And we'll send you off to rehearsal in plenty of time. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts on this. And if you had another question for Dr. Vorma, go right ahead, Ricardo.
I have 1,000 questions for him, but we don't have time.
No, but I have time to thank you again. This has been a wonderful conversation and great questions. So.
Thank you.
Yeah,
we'll have it online as well for those who missed part of it and can hear it again at WMUK.org. And final reminder, the concert is Sunday at 3 o'clock, featuring both the University Symphonic Band and the University Wind Symphony, directed by Dr. Scott Vorma, and featuring Dr. Ricardo Lorenz's new piece, or I don't know if it's a new piece, The Wall. Is this...
Well, I mean, it's always new. I mean, a lot of people haven't heard it, so for all practical purposes, it is new.
Well, we'll go back to 1937 now.
It's always a delight to see you, Kara.
Thanks, Scott.